KAXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon.
History will dictate if this is a turning point for our country. But every single one of us gets to choose right now if this is a turning point for us.
Governor Spencer Cox of Utah, yesterday, this hour, the latest in the investigation into Charlie Kirk's assassination and concerns about political violence. Also, Brazil's former president convicted of planning a coup will have reaction from Rio. Gina Vanesco's memoir about the pain in getting the silent treatment from a mother. And Humphreys McGee builds musical Legos. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, September 13, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Minnesota county leaders are expecting a significant shift in cost to their budget from the state and federal governments because of various legislation. In Beltrami County, proposed cuts to libraries and the local history museum are on the table to offset the burden. Larissa Donovan has the story.
County Administrator Tom Barry says a committee worked to deliver an increase of less than 10% to the proposed property tax levy for 2026. At a recent meeting, he pointed to cost shifts as driving factors, including for probation, health and human services like Medicaid and SNAP, and the state's new Paid Family and Medical Leave Act.
That's why the tax pie is starting to get bigger. And you can expect that to grow if the state continues down the path that it's headed.
The board set a list of budget priorities earlier in the year, which included financing mission-focused operations such as health and human services before giving money to outside organizations. This includes the library system and historical society. At the Bemidji Public Library, branch manager Sherilyn Warren says the proposed reduction will bring the county's contribution down to what's known as the minimum maintenance of effort as part of the state's library system. This year, Beltrami County gave nearly $438,000 to the Bemidji and Black Deck libraries. The Kitchigami Regional Library System requested just over $450,000 for the two libraries for 2026, but Beltrami County proposes far less, about $265,000.
Even if we committed to cutting all material purchases for 2026, which is not buying any new materials, we would still have to find over $100,000 to cut from our budget for 2026. And feasibly, the only way to do that would be to cut hours of operation and to cut staffing levels.
Beltrami County Historical Society's Executive Director Emily Thabe says Beltrami County's proposed $7,500 cut represents about 8% of the center's annual budget.
Dollars that we miss now, that is history that turns to dust. It is history that rusts and crumbles and is not digitized and is not saved. And it's decades that gets washed away from our memories.
The county is expected to set its preliminary budget and levy for 2026 at its meeting Tuesday. The levy amount can be decreased between then and December when the final decision is made. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Drivers should expect delays on Highway 2 in Grand Rapids next week. The Minnesota Department of Transportation says milling and paving work begins Monday. Work will take place in the city the first 2 days, including on Southeast 7th Avenue and Northeast 8th Avenue. Tuesday through Friday, crews will work between Northeast 3rd Street and Culp Road east of La Prairie. There may be extended delays, especially during commuting hours. MnDOT says to expect flagging operations, lane closures, and pilot cars. Highway 7 near Iron Junction will close for about 5 days starting Monday. St. Louis County says crews will be working on the CN Railroad crossing between Old Mesabi Road and Ramshaw Road North. The recommended detour is lengthy, routing drivers to Highway 53 via Highway 37 or through Eveleth. The University of Minnesota is accepting nominations from Northwestern Minnesota for its Growing Local Leadership course. The program aims to address the growing governmental and nonprofit leadership shortage in the state. The hybrid course includes online and in-person meetings at Shooting Star Casino in Manoman. The sliding scale fee includes meals and lodging. Nominators are asked to consider young adults, college students, new residents, empty nesters, and people from underrepresented groups as future leaders for their communities. The U uses a broad definition of Northwest Minnesota, stretching from Morris to Park Rapids to Bedette. Applications and nominations close Monday. Find more information at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at kaxe.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Yesterday, Utah officials announced the arrest of the man they believe fired the shot that killed Charlie Kirk on the campus of Utah Valley University. Of course, there's still questions about the why. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering the investigation and joins us in our studios. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let us begin with the suspect. What's known about him?
His name is Tyler Robinson. He's 22 years old. He's from Washington, Utah, which is down in the southwestern corner of the state. A colleague of ours, David Kondos, who's a reporter with KUER, NPR's member station in Utah, talked to some of the Robinson family's neighbors in Washington. One of them is Kristen Schwerman. She said that she wanted authorities to find the gunman, but this isn't who she wanted it to be. She also said this about Robinson.
He was a smart kid, quiet. You know, I used to see him out doing yard work all the time when he was younger. He had a full ride scholarship, I guess.
She also said that she worked at the local elementary school where Robinson and his brothers went as kids. She says the family is a normal, hardworking family. They go to the same church in town. She also said this about learning that he was the gunman.
It was a shock that it was him, but I so feel sorry for his mother and his dad. Because that's not how they raised him.
And what led investigators to Tyler Robinson?
Utah's Republican Governor Spencer Cox talked about how this all went down. Here's a bit of what he said.
On the evening of September 11th, a family member of Tyler Robinson reached out to a family friend who contacted the Washington County Sheriff's Office with information that Robinson had confessed to them or implied that he had committed the incident.
Now, that information was passed along to state and federal authorities, and FBI Director Kash Patel said Robinson was arrested around 10 p.m. local time on Thursday night. Now, investigators also dug into social media. They interviewed Robinson's family, and Cox said that one family member told investigators that Robinson had become more political in recent years. Cox also said that the family member recounted a recent dinner that Robinson was at and that Robinson had mentioned that Kirk was going to be speaking at Utah Valley University, which, of course, is where Kirk was killed. Cox also said that in that dinner conversation, Robinson and a family member talked about why they didn't like Kirk and the viewpoints that he espoused.
Any indication about motive yet?
Well, look, that's always the huge question mark hanging over a shooting like this. Neither Cox nor Patel directly addressed that question, the question of motive. But they did offer clues that could point to that issue, one being the conversation about Kirk that I just mentioned. But Cox also said that investigators found writing etched onto the shell casings that they found in the gun that they believe was used in the shooting. The writing on one unfired casing read, "Hey, fascist, catch," along with some arrow symbols. Another read, "Oh, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Chow, Chow," which could be a reference to an old Italian anti-fascist song, or could be an online gaming reference. As our colleague Odette Youssef has reported, analysts in internet extremism are cautious about reading too much into these very limited hints about Robinson's views. They say that even though some of the engravings on their face may signal anti-fascist views, some of the slogans have been used by specific far-right groups to troll others that they consider to be more mainstream conservative, all of which is to say it's too soon to answer the motive question or political angle.
What are you looking for next?
Well, obviously, the motive question is really the big one hanging over all of this. Investigators are going to be going through Robinson's phones, his internet search history, his social media, interviewing more people who knew him to try to get a sense of that. And it's going to take time. And since Robinson is now a defendant in this case, that information is going to come out in court papers as authorities pursue the prosecution against him.
Ryan Lucas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump says he will attend Charlie Kirk's funeral in Arizona. Details about the service haven't been released. NPR senior political editor Ron Elving joins us. Ron, thanks so much for being here.
Good to be with you, Scott.
What are your thoughts about Charlie Kirk's assassination and the reaction even before a suspect was identified?
There was the shock of seeing someone slain in such a way when so young, just 31, with a wife and two small children, someone so talented and driven. You did not have to share Kirk's viewpoint or condone all of his rhetoric or his provocations. You just had to appreciate his energy and obvious gifts of persuasion. And he gave every sign of being a force in American politics for years to come, whether elected or not. And it was appalling, of course, to witness the reaction, not the grieving in public, but the warring on social media, the instant willingness to blame it all on the other side of the divide.
Utah's Governor Cox has been very measured in his response. Of course, he's a Republican in a deeply conservative state and has said bluntly he sees this killing as part of a pattern of political violence and asking everybody to think about, quote, where we are and where we want to be.
Yes, Cox had the elevation on all of this you want to see in our leaders, and he directed his outrage at those who would exploit the tragedy and deepen the divisions among us, including the purveyors of hate speech from the left and the right on social media. You have to wish that all of our national leaders could have done as well as Cox.
Well, last week we were discussing President Trump's plans to send the National Guard to Chicago. Yesterday on Fox and Friends, he indicated a change of plans.
We're going to Memphis. Memphis is...
That's the next city.
...deeply troubled. And the mayor is happy. He's a Democrat mayor. The mayor is happy. And the governor, Tennessee, the governor is happy.
Well, first, we should note that the mayor of Memphis, Paul Young, made it clear last night he was not happy. But he also added that he wanted to work with the Guard and make the best of the added help. And he also agreed with other elected Democrats in the region, saying that cities do need the resources to fight crime. Not a show of force from the Guard, but the resources that support that would be helpful to them. And one criticism we're hearing of this, send in the Guard surge, is that it's largely a cover for stepped-up deportations. That's the increase in arrests that we're seeing in some of these places, and that's what's producing the numbers and not some grand turnaround in the overall crime rate. So we'll see what remains in place when these deployments end. And as for targeting Memphis instead of Chicago, it surely had to do with the attitude of the governors. A confrontation such as Trump was pushing with the city of Chicago would not have been well-timed, given what's happened with Charlie Kirk, given what's happening in Ukraine and Gaza. And we should mention also there's a report in the Washington Post this morning that they're talking about a National Guard surge in Louisiana that might last, according to the Post's reporting, for 2 years.
Kirk's assassination seems to have set off some partisan reaction, finger pointing in the House, and real concerns about the security of lawmakers. And that would not seem to help the chances for the parties to come to an agreement to avoid a government shutdown in a few weeks.
As you say, the one thing uniting the parties on Capitol Hill these days is fear. Fear for their own personal safety and the safety of their colleagues. And that is no joke. But perhaps even that meager shred of shared interest could achieve some good purpose. Congress needs to achieve a compromise to fund the government and all its programs past the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. The Charlie Kirk moment could make that kind of compromise impossible. Or it could make such a compromise so imperative that members of Congress would see it that way, too.
NPR's Ron Elving, very good to speak to you as always, but especially this week. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
It is daunting to try to recall all the politically motivated attacks and attempted attacks in America over the last few years. This year alone, someone set fire to the Pennsylvania governor's residence while Governor Josh Shapiro and his family slept upstairs. Yaron Leshinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram, Israeli embassy workers, were shot and killed in Washington, D.C. 82-year-old Karen Diamond died, and several others were burned in a firebombing attack on a march in Boulder, Colorado. A week after that, Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark were shot and killed in their home. The Hortman's killer also shot State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette, who survived. Last year, there were two attempts to assassinate Donald Trump during his presidential campaign. One bullet only narrowly missed its mark, grazing Trump's ear, but a supporter sitting behind him was killed. Early in 2022, someone tried to shoot Craig Greenberg, then running for mayor of Louisville. The bullets came close but missed. That summer, a man was arrested outside the home of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh with plans to assassinate the justice. In the fall, Paul Pelosi, husband of then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was attacked with a hammer inside the couple's San Francisco home. We may have vivid memories of rioters storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, trying to prevent a joint session of Congress from certifying the votes of the Electoral College. But do we remember that the same day pipe bombs were found outside both the Democratic and Republican National Committee headquarters, where they could have exploded and killed people? Or that in 2020 the FBI uncovered a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer? And in 2017, a man shot up a congressional baseball practice in Northern Virginia, wounding four people, including Congressman Steve Scalise. I'm sure there are more examples I haven't mentioned. Different sides seem to keep their own lists of losses. But I have deliberately not described the targets of these attacks with their party affiliation or ideology. Background and beliefs vary, but they all share humanity and the right to live in this country, worship, vote, and argue for their beliefs without fearing for their lives. Listening to NPR News.
Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet tomorrow from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota is looking for lunch buddy mentors at elementary schools in Aurora, Cherry, Chisholm, Eveleth, Hibbing, Keewatin, Mountain Iron, and Virginia. The deadline to apply is September 26. Find more information at unitedwaymn.org/volunteer. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on KAXE.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KAXE provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day, I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Dickinson College, awarding the Rose Walters Prize for Global Environmental Activism to combat climate change and inspire future leaders. Learn more at dickinson.edu/RWP. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Brazil is contending with reaction from the unprecedented trial and conviction of former President Jair Bolsonaro for attempting to overthrow the government. Despite receiving a 27-year sentence this week, he remains one of Brazil's most influential figures. The far-right populace still inspires both admiration and outrage, as Julia Carneiro reports from Rio.
It's the day after the verdict, and it feels like carnival here in downtown Rio, with musicians and revelers on the street and banners saying no amnesty to coup mongers. I've come to see how these people feel about Bolsonaro's conviction. Rafael Souto is dressed in a prisoner uniform with black and white stripes, cap included. Why are you here celebrating, Rafael?
Bolsonaro is so bad politician. He made so many bad things, and we are very happy now because he will be in the jail for 27 years.
Natalia Ferreira is here with a sticker on her chest saying Bolsonaro in prison. Why have you come, Natalia?
I came because today is a very important day for us. I feel like today we finally have at least a little bit of justice. And now I feel like we can finally breathe, we can finally try to change what this country has become.
It's hard to overstate the impact of the verdict on a country that still remembers 21 years of military dictatorship. The conviction of a former president for plotting a coup is a seismic moment for this relatively young democracy. Justice Luiz Roberto Barroso, president of the Supreme Court, called the trial a watershed moment. I believe we are closing the chapters of regression in Brazilian history, he said, marked by coups and the breakdown of constitutional order. But Brazil is polarized as ever. The Bolsonaro supporters are outraged with the verdict. His defense called the sentence excessive and is considering appeals. Senator Flávio Bolsonaro says his father remains, quote, firm and strong, holding his head high to face his persecution head on. He claims history will show that Bolsonaro was, quote, on the right side. Even before the trial ended, thousands of Bolsonaro supporters took to the streets, denouncing the process as illegitimate and calling for amnesty. In São Paulo, days ahead of the verdict, demonstrators waved Brazilian and U.S. flags, expressing gratitude to President Trump for his support of Bolsonaro, which led the U.S. to impose 50% tariffs on Brazilian goods last month.
There's a man here draped in the Brazilian flag, wearing a Donald Trump mask, and lots of people are taking turns taking pictures with him.
But polls show 90% of Brazilians think otherwise, saying the U.S. tariffs will hit their wallets, with credible fear there's more U.S. retaliation to come. But demonstrator Adjalmo Grando is optimistic. He tells me that Bolsonaro's sentence doesn't signal the end of the movement he launched. Quite the reverse.
Bolsonaro is just the beginning of the right wing. Just the beginning. We will always be reborn again. Bolsonaro is just a seed of the right wing.
For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio de Janeiro.
Missouri has joined the ranks of states answering President Trump's call to help Republicans win next year's midterm elections. On Friday, the legislature passed a new congressional map that would turn a seat held by a Democrat into a Republican-leaning district, as Trump had asked. This comes after Texas passed a map that could help Republicans win 5 additional seats there. California and some other Democratic-led states are moving to counter this in what's turning into a nationwide redistricting race. We're joined now by St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Help us understand the debate that went on there in Missouri. Why did Republicans say they passed this?
Well, Missouri Republicans have told me that since the state elects GOP candidates soundly on a statewide and state legislative level, the congressional map should reflect the party's political dominance. In fact, Governor Mike Kehoe calls this map the Missouri First Plan. A lot of GOP lawmakers, such as Senate President Pro Tem Cindy O'Loughlin, say their motivation is to not let Democrats take control of the House.
When the people in Missouri say, do we want to be sure we send as many Republicans to Congress as we can so that President Trump can finish out his 4 years in a strong fashion? The answer to that is yes.
GOP lawmakers like O'Loughlin passed the current map just 3 years ago. And back then, her Republican colleagues didn't want to target Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. They feared it would make surrounding districts more competitive. But Trump himself called Missouri Republican senators earlier this week to encourage them to pass the new lines. And many lawmakers contend their constituents like Trump and will support keeping the House in GOP hands.
What kind of resistance did they get?
Democrats in particular excoriated Republicans for being subservient to Trump and trying to oust Cleaver, a veteran lawmaker who served as the first black mayor of Kansas City. Kansas City lawmakers like State Senator Barbara Washington say the map will ultimately silence and dilute the voice of urban Missourians.
One side is representing the interests of the people and the voices of the people, and another side is representing the interests of power, because they want to be in power more than they want to help their communities.
Now, the Missouri governor is expected to sign this soon, but the map is not necessarily a done deal. A group called People Not Politicians plan to gather more than 100,000 signatures over a 3-month period to put the map up for a statewide vote. And if they get those signatures, the map can't go into effect probably until after the 2026 election cycle. Meanwhile, 2 lawsuits have already been filed against the new map.
Now, Jason, state legislatures, of course, have the power to redistrict, but this does come at an unusual time, doesn't it?
It's very unusual. In fact, almost all states pursue redistricting directly after a census, which comes early in the decade. But with Republicans holding a very small majority in the House, Trump and other Republicans believe that the party needs to do everything possible before next year's elections. If Democrats take the House, they could block his agenda and launch investigations of his administration.
Do you know what other states, Jason, might be looking at this now?
The big one is California, specifically to counter the 5 Texas seats that are now easier for Republicans to win. Democrats in California are asking voters to approve a map that would help them win 5 seats there. In the meantime, Trump is asking Indiana, Florida, and other Republican states to pass new maps to help the GOP, and more could come.
Jason Rosenbaum of St. Louis Public Radio, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Trump administration has released a 20-page report called Make Our Children Healthy Again. There's a lot about the dangers of alcohol, controlled substances, and vaping, but not a mention of tobacco and nicotine.
Attempting to combat chronic disease without tobacco control is like attempting a triathlon without a bicycle. You're destined for failure before leaving the starting line.
Tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha, loosening the grip of tobacco control and what it could mean for the health of children. You can listen by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Aid is slow to be delivered in Afghanistan, where several powerful earthquakes struck last week. The UN Humanitarian Office in Afghanistan says 441 villages are in the affected area. More than 2,000 people have died, thousands more injured, according to the Taliban government. They've launched a domestic fundraising campaign and are also asking for international aid. Nassar Abdiyani immigrated to the United States from Afghanistan, but he still has family in Jalalabad and Kunar. places that are near the epicenter of the quakes. He is also vice president of the Afghan Cultural Society in California. Joins us now from Concord, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And may I ask, have you been able to reach your family? Do you know anything about them?
Yes. So we have an immediate family in Jalalabad and also in Kunar province, where it was the center of the earthquake. My second cousin, unfortunately, they passed away. The roof collapsed on them. But the remaining of my family members, they are okay. They are alive, thanks God. But their houses are not livable.
What has life been like for your family day to day?
You know, when it rains, it pours. Unfortunately, after the earthquake, there was a rain as well, too. And they're all living in the yard and the street and the farm. No sanitation. There's absolutely nothing there. So we have to immediately send some tents for them to just cover them, because they're calling us and they're saying, hey, we need this. And the earthquake started around like after midnight, and everybody just walked out of their rooms. So their clothing is all inside the house, and they're scared even to just go inside the house to get additional clothing. The kids, when they left the houses, they don't have no shoes. So we have to immediately send approximately around 350 to 400 sandals and some socks to just cover their feet while they're walking on this environment. And the environment is not a smooth street or concrete or anything like that. It's a farmland. There's a scorpion, snake, and anything else that you can imagine that it exists there.
We know that there have been many losses of people living in the area where many people have died, been able to take care of them.
Unfortunately, that the Afghanistan, you know, especially Kunar province, we do not have too much land. It's majority of the mountain. Digging a hole there to put these dead body there, it is becoming a massive challenge, and people are exhausted. So even they spoke to some priests, and they did allow them to put two bodies in one grave because they couldn't dig anymore. You can't imagine it. When I saw the video, when my cousin, they were just showing me on a live, and it was just, I couldn't watch it. Two babies in one grave, or father and a son, or mother and a daughter in one grave. The little farmed land that they had, it's full with cemetery now.
Mr. Abdiani, may I ask what it's like for you to feel so tied to events and concerned for your family and yet be so far away?
It's a mixed feeling. It's just a feel of anger, disappointment, and fear. We cannot fly there to go help out. Financially, sending money for Afghan individual, it's a huge challenge for whatever political reason that it is in Afghanistan. We cannot help, and we want to help.
You mentioned the political difficulty of helping. Help us understand that.
Well, it's a Taliban. They have a lot of restriction. Like, we desperately, we need female doctors in that province. There's none. We don't have too many women's doctors in Afghanistan anymore. As you guys probably know, when the Taliban came, they closed the schools for women. So most of them, they left the country. But any number that they are still in Afghanistan, they want to volunteer. They want to go to those camps. They want to go to that ground zero to help out. But they are being turned around. That's what we heard by Taliban. They're not allowed to go there. Last what I heard is that they're trying to even stop some of the individuals that they're bringing fund and they're bringing money or whatever they need to devastated people. They're putting stop on that, and they want the fund, everything go through the government, raising other questions. Are they going to distribute the fund or not? How are they going to distribute? How are they going to help out? Are they going to help one village and not the other village?
As you know, the United States has made significant cuts to foreign aid funding to many countries, including Afghanistan. What does your family say is most needed now that the world can provide?
They need help for the recovery. Those houses have to be built. The school has to be built. The streets have to be built. The mosque has to be built. And then the main fear that the Afghan community here and in Afghanistan they have is how many orphans are survived or how many survivors are there. We see the videos, and I talk to my cousins constantly. They're saying is, yes, we found one or two child in this house or in that house. So that is the biggest challenge right now, that the whole community is fearing that what's going to happen to the survivor and how it's going to be the recovery process. I'm pleading on behalf of Afghan community, help Afghans. Afghan been through a lot in past over 40 years, war after war after war. We need your help.
Nisar Abdiani, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I greatly appreciate that, to take our voice to your audience. That means a lot to us.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Death cap mushrooms were in the headlines this week after an Australian woman received a life sentence for fatally poisoning some of her family members with the toxic fungus. But recent research has revealed new and frankly intriguing information about the mushrooms. Ann Pringle is a mycologist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You work with colleagues from Yale, Portugal, Germany, and I gather in your research you have discovered there are some toxins that maybe you'd missed before that they're creating.
That's right. So the death cap is famous because it kills people. People can eat it because they mistake the mushroom for something that is edible. And so we've known for a very, very long time that the death cap is poisonous. But what exactly the full range of the poisons is in the species hasn't been known. So we use DNA sequence data and we discovered that there are a lot more toxins in the death cap than anyone had previously suspected.
Death caps are spreading?
Yeah, when we think about conservation biology, we often think about the plants that we care about or especially the animals that we care about, but most biodiversity on Earth isn't plant or animal. It belongs to other kingdoms, some of which we haven't even really defined very well. And the death cap, when I first started working with it, I'm not sure I cared too much that it was poisonous. It's intriguing because it's from one place and it's spreading in another place. And invasive mushrooms are just something we don't know a lot about.
It's spreading in California?
Yeah, it's spreading particularly in California. Other places as well, but really a hot spot for where the death caps are is in Northern California, around the San Francisco Bay Area.
Why? Do we know?
Well, it must be something about having compatible trees that it can associate with, and it must be something about the requirements that it needs as an organism to grow. There's lots of ideas about why invasive species are invasive. That literature is really focused on plants and animals. Some of the same things might be true, but some of the same things might not be true. That's one of the reasons the toxins actually, ultimately, I find them so fascinating, is that the toxins may be somehow a key to how the death cap is spreading and is so abundant now in California. It's, in general, much more abundant in California than it is in its native habitats.
And I have to ask, recognizing this is a family show and we have to be careful, how do death cap mushrooms reproduce?
Well, the traditional, I suppose, way that a mushroom reproduces is that two bodies fuse. After those two bodies fuse, they grow for a while, for some amount of time, and then a mushroom is made out of that fused body. But in California, the death caps seem to be able to make mushrooms without fusing. In other words, an individual body can just make mushrooms by itself.
I understand your fascination now. What do we learn about the biodiversity of our world by taking a look at death caps?
I think the profound lesson that I walk away with is how much is changing that we aren't noticing. I often feel like my job is to bear witness to the changes that are happening in the world, and I do that through this really painstaking, careful study of one species, but it's just one species, and the same dynamics that we're watching with the death cap are likely playing out with a lot of other mushrooms, but there isn't anyone around who happens to be lucky enough to have the time and space to watch it happen.
Ann Pringle, mycologist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Good morning, it's 7:39. You're listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, we're going to the dogs, cats too. Stories about the friends who will never let us down. That is also airing tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock. 10 o'clock this morning, Dan Lentz is your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from Lakeland PBS. Stay connected with Lakeland News, offering local news, weather, and sports. Available on demand on the PBS app. And you can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You can save time and money while defending the KAXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. Thank you so much for your support. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition.
I'm Duahli Saikautau with these headlines. A 22-year-old suspect is in police custody in connection with the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. His wife, Erica, publicly thanked law enforcement last night, saying police acted bravely to make sure there were no other victims. Russia attacked Ukraine with more than 160 drones and another ballistic missile, according to Ukrainian officials. This as NATO met to discuss Russia's incursion into Poland airspace. A recently unsealed indictment shows that six leaders of La Luz del Mundo megachurch based in Mexico are facing federal charges of racketeering, child pornography, and sex trafficking. I'm Duahli Saikautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. For generations, children and adults have created entire worlds out of Legos, but the progressive jam band Umphrey's McGee has given those building blocks a new application. And that's Out of Focus, the lead single from their new album, Blueprints. It's made up of spontaneously created sections of music they call Legos that are taken from live performance and put together with lyrics and other new elements. Voila, they become songs. Guitarist and vocalist Brendan Bayless and keyboardist and vocalist Joel Cummins of Umphrey's McGee joins us now from Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
Brendan, what is Lego to the band? How did this come about?
Well, in the very beginning stages of songwriting, we were looking at entire pieces, seeing what would work. You know, some people would have sections of songs or a verse or a chorus. And when you start collaborating with other people, sometimes someone would have a B section that would work with someone else's A section. That was kind of a natural starting point. And then when we started improvising live on stage, there were certain moments that were actually really good. And we listened back and decided to keep that part from that jam that night.
It's just the idea of what can we create and let the fans into the creative process a little bit. So, you know, if it goes well, they feel like they're part of something magical. And if it doesn't, then we can blame them.
Mm-hmm.
And Brendan Bayless, some of these Legos go back nearly 20 years, don't they? I mean, for example, parts of the song Exit Signs, I gather, are pulled from improvs and 2006.
There are certain moments on stage that feel so good that they kind of stick around in the back of your head as, oh, that was good. That's going to be something that already has a feel like it's a verse, or this sounds like it's a chorus waiting to be finished. Sometimes I'll make a mental note of it or write it into my notebook. But in this case, it's bizarre that it took that long to find a home, because apparently it was a fan favorite thing. Shake it off, see the exit sign.
You were ad-libbing some of the lyrics, right?
Yes. On stage playing the show, I started to hear a vocal melody. So I looked over, and there's literally the red and white exit sign by the back door. I started taking the melody and turning it into lyrically about the exit sign. Then listening back to try and write concrete, real lyrics, I turned that concept in my head into the exit sign of a highway. So it became a couple in a car driving together.
Let me ask you, in both the songs Concessions and Wide Open, you bring up some advice for sharing, don't you?
Lyrically, yeah. Sometimes I'm just trying to give myself advice because I don't listen to myself. Maybe I can read it back in the lyrics and it'll stick. Sharing so much free advice. It's not easy to ignore. No one's gonna tell you twice. But I need something to draw.
And Joel Cummins, what's the future for this Lego concept of making an album? Want to try it again?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, as far as I know, this is the first ever album by an artist that has been a complete collaboration with their fans. So I think that we'll definitely have more songs that come this way. But for now, I think, you know, we're going to kind of let it stand on its own as this pretty unique creation.
How do you think of that relationship you have with your fans?
Well, it's interesting because obviously without their support, we wouldn't be anywhere. We really owe all the success to them and them having the faith in us, and they keep coming back and they encourage us to take the risks. So it's a very reciprocal kind of relationship, but there's also at some points the line gets a little blurred and you have to remember that as a band, our opinion should be the one that we factor in the most. I think when you start catering to a specific formula that works for your fan base, it might backfire eventually because it'll seem like you're just replaying the same old kind of vibes.
Well, they depend on you to learn and grow, don't they?
Yeah, and vice versa. The fact that they want us to improvise and they want us to keep producing new songs and they don't want us to keep playing the same things, it kind of puts us in a really good spot because the funnest part is when you have a finished product and you can look back on something that was once an idea and is now an actual vinyl spinning on a record player at your house.
That's Brendan Bayliss and Joel Cummins of Humphreys McGee. The band's new album, Blueprints, is out now. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
By mutual agreement and with some excitement, Jeannie Vanasco's mother, Barbara, moved into the renovated basement apartment of her daughter's home in Baltimore, and then began to treat Jeannie with silence.
Signs she's avoiding or preparing to avoid me. I open the door off my dining room, call down, "Mom?" And she doesn't answer, even though I heard her moving around moments ago. She texts two-letter replies, such as, "okay," and "no." She locks the door off the dining room. She takes out her trash before sunrise. She stops feeding the squirrels and birds. She keeps her lights off. She keeps her phone off. She stacks cardboard boxes in the laundry room or garage or on the deck. Sometimes she includes a moving checklist with the names of retirement communities hundreds of miles away in Ohio. She writes letters. Her cruelest claims, "we never did get along." Her softest reads, "I love you, but I think we do better at a distance."
Sometimes the silent treatment would last a few days, once for half a year. Silent Treatment is Jeannie Vanasco's new memoir, and she joins us from our studios in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What would set off a silence, or do you know?
I wouldn't always know. And I think that was what was so anxiety-inducing about it, was because I would end up in this loop of thinking, oh, is it because I went to Home Depot without her? Is she upset that my partner and I have COVID without her? I mean, she stopped talking to us at one point. It was like a week into my partner and I having COVID. And I thought, okay, surely I didn't do anything wrong there in not giving my 80-year-old mother COVID.
You were trying to fill in the blanks.
It was constant, constant. She would explain it as if this was a very mature thing to do. She would say, I don't want to say something I'd regret. And so for her, it was her removing herself from a situation so as not to cause pain. And so I stopped taking it personally, or I tried not to take it personally. I began to understand, okay, she's doing this for herself. It's a coping mechanism, that kind of retreat.
You dedicate the book to your mother. Your mother knew that you were writing this book, right?
Oh, yes, I told her. So the idea for the book came after my mom's six-month period of silence, where I thought, well, that was awful, and maybe it would be interesting to write about. And so I did tell her. I said, I think I found a framing device. Then she said, well, that sounds interesting. And I have told her, I said, look, here are some things that are in it. Is this okay? And she's like, Jeannie, I'm old. What do I care what people think? It's your book. It's not my book.
Did the silent treatment have the effect of making you think more about your mother?
It had the effect of, I felt a lot more empathy for her. I would talk with friends or my therapist and like, why can't you let yourself get angry at your mom? And I was like, well, she's going through such a hard time. And I was thinking a lot more about her and thinking about all the reasons she was inflicting silence. And
she had a rough first marriage, too, right?
Her first marriage was extremely abusive. And so her mother was extremely physically abusive. So my mom didn't view the silent treatment as abusive. I brought it up at one point. I wanted to be very cautious about using the word abuse. But I did tell her, it's like, you know, some people say it's abusive. And she said, really? And I was like, yeah, like it can be hurtful. And I mean, some of the research I did, they have found that social ostracism activates the same area of the brain that physical abuse activates. And so it does feel, for me, it was one of the most painful experiences of my life. The only comparison I can think of is when my dad died when I was 18. It was extremely painful.
You and your mother have the same name.
It's so confusing, yes. So I was supposed to be named Jeannie, and my dad then thought he would be doing something sweet by naming me after my mom. He thought it would be a nice surprise. So while she was asleep, he named me after her. It has caused a lot of problems. We got flagged for voter fraud recently because we have the same name, and for a while we had the same address. My credit score improved because they thought I opened my first line of credit when I was in preschool. So that, I mean, there was a plus. I mean, I thought it was very funny when at times my mom was using the silent treatment, and I'd gotten us gym memberships at this women's only gym near us. And I had asked if I could put a hold on her account, and they were having trouble finding her in the system. And I remember they asked me, like, oh, your mom has the same address, is listed as the same address. Is that a mistake? And I thought, yes and no.
In a sense, it might be.
Yeah.
She left you a very touchy note once.
Mm-hmm.
After you filed her taxes.
Yes.
Your mother wrote, it's all on me, not you. I don't know why I don't communicate. I love you.
I have never been so grateful in my life for my mom to ask me to do her taxes, because I would often do them. Yeah, I mean, that broke a particular silence. And I know she felt awful when it was over. I really think it was beyond her control. This was something she had done throughout her life. It worked for her. And you know, when a silence was over, I mean, my mom returned to becoming, in my mind, the most wonderful mother in the world. I mean, I love my mom. I just have, I have accepted that this is something she does, and I am a lot more patient with it. She hasn't done it for a long time now, though, I will say.
What's a long time?
More than a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever seek professional help for your mother?
When she moved to Baltimore, a doctor had suggested to her that maybe she see a therapist. Like, you know, you've gone through a lot of changes, this is hard, and she shut it down right away. She said, I'm not crazy. So we let it go. And then after the 6-month silence, I did suggest to her, I said, look, Mom, there's no shame. And she said, you know, I probably should talk to someone. I should have talked to someone after your father died. And then I was relieved. And then 2 weeks later, she's like, I'm not seeing a therapist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't, no one can do it for you.
Absolutely. I'm okay with spoilers. I don't think this is a big spoiler, but she moved across the street from me, like directly across the street. So it's a straight line from my porch to hers. And I think having her own space made a huge, huge difference.
I'm left among so many other things thinking we sometimes tell ourselves we're doing something to avoid hurting someone we love. And then have to get used to the fact that what we're doing because we don't want to hurt them is exactly what hurts them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to solve that either.
I have no idea. I think that's why I turned to writing, to figure out questions I don't know how to answer. But I did write it out of love. So I hope that comes through, especially to her.
Jeannie Vanasco, her new memoir, A Silent Treatment. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's just before 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9, and you can find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you for your support. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pekegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Some patchy fog this morning, partly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, our lows tonight in the upper 50s, and tomorrow, highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s and partly sunny. Looking ahead to Monday, chance of showers, partly sunny, highs near 80 with breezy south winds. At 7 o'clock tonight, it's green cheese trivia with Julie Crabb and Justine Jacobson. Right now, it's